Well, Pauline, I thought maybe we'd start with a few questions on your book, American Scripture, Making the Declaration of Independence, which has gotten a big splash, as you undoubtedly know. You go out of your way to place the Declaration of Independence in an historical context, and you mention several documents that influenced Jefferson, either consciously or unconsciously, and I wondered if you could talk about maybe some of these important influences on the Declaration.
I dug out those documents, I think, to counter what I perceived to be a prevailing view that the Declaration of Independence was a unique document, one of a kind, the only one similar to it. And you know, my historian's impulses just said that can't be so. Things don't come like flashes, out of the sky in this peculiar way. It needed to have precedence. And I started just poking around. What I found that was most exciting to me were local statements on the reasons for independence. And these were strangely printed in the 1840s, but had been forgotten by and large. I found them in Peter Force's American Archives. And the first ones I came across were from Massachusetts.
This is before the Declaration or after?
Precisely. They're before the Declaration of Independence. They're statements on towns. These were from towns meant to influence their provincial congresses, which were, the extra legal legislatures, the operative governments of the colonies. In Massachusetts, it was actually the Assembly, to get them to instruct their delegates to Congress that they should support independence. So it was part of a widespread political process. The general court had actually asked the towns on May 10, 1776, the resolution went something like the following: if the Honorable Continental Congress decides for the safety of the American colonies to declare them independent of Great Britain, are you, the inhabitants of the towns, prepared to defend that decision with your lives and fortunes? And it was stated in a very touchingly personal way. And what I discovered was the towns didn't say, yes or no, or fail to answer at all, which of course some did because they understood this is a very risky business. But they sometimes laid out their answers in great detail. I mean, they made a statement on this issue, why they supported independence, what events had led them to that decision. And I found some of these very moving. And some of the short ones are even more moving. I mean, the one that I keep remembering, and I do quote it in the book, indeed I reproduce it in one of the appendices, was from a small town named Ashby, which is, off the beaten track. It's somewhere in north central Massachusetts. It was never an important place in the 18th century. It's not an important place now, except for the people who live there, I suppose, for whom it is very important. And they said that we, the inhabitants, will most solemnly defend that decision with our lives and fortunes. And you knew these farmers sat down and debated that proposition, and they knew what it meant.
What did it mean? Did they actually sign it personally?
Well, the punishment for treason in English law was forfeiture of estate and death. Mm-hmm. And lives and fortunes meant, basically they're putting their neck on the line. They debated it and they decided yes, understanding what the consequences were. And the notion that these farmers in out-of-the-way places would debate this decision, that decision, with such seriousness, and never doubt that their opinion was of some significance, I found very moving. And after you've worked in a field for 20, 30 years, as I have, and you've come across a document that you say, you say, I found something. And then I found there were more of these. They came out of Virginia. They came out of Maryland. There were militia groups in Pennsylvania that made similar statements. That, I think, was the great historical find that led into the book. But
how did these compare with these compare with the actual Declaration of Independence? Are they the same in form, or do they mention the same grievances?
There's an evolution in them, I think. They became more eloquent as time went on, as they became documents issued by, say, provincial assemblies or congresses, extra legal congresses, as declarations. Then there would be the same kind of reference to large Enlightenment principles that you would get so movingly in Jefferson's text. The earlier ones were much more down to earth, explaining why, the way people felt. They were often less rhetorical, the early ones. And I found that very moving because you could sort of hear, you could not sort of, you could in fact hear the voice of 18th century people and some of the localisms. From the north, they were a little different. Some you'd find from the south, a little different. There was something very distinctive, although the content was very much alike. Unlike the Declaration of Independence, they didn't cite a long list of grievances. They had maybe 4 to 6. And to me, they made a case for independence that was more immediately understandable. The Declaration of Independence speaks in gross generalities that even people at the time sometimes had difficulty associating with specific events. If you've got the local events, they would say, he hasn't answered our petitions. We asked for redress, he just gave us worse grievances. He's burned our towns. He's declared our ships the same as those as alien nations. He's turning German mercenaries against us. And basically they said, if we don't declare independence and get help somewhere, we're going to get smeared. Mm-hmm. And they self-defense, that survival is a primary law. That's our justification. If we don't do this, we're going to be destroyed. That's our argument. That's our justification. And it was very convincing to me. I think we can understand that argument. It speaks to us in an immediate, straightforward way, where the Declaration is much more rhetorical.
Would Jefferson have read these, as your point, that he was influenced by them, or simply that this was in the wind and that Jefferson's was not a unique document, just it was one of
well,
many?
Well, I think, would he? It's a very good question. I think some of these he would have known. They appeared in the Virginia press. I was less given to seeing language continuities between Jefferson's text and the local ones, although I saw one reviewer that picked up phrases out of the Buckingham County, Virginia statement and noticed that there were some similarities in the Declaration. This is always, of course, very speculative if you find in just a few phrases that seem to recur. What I think was clearly in Jefferson's mind of earlier precedents were more obvious documents. For example, the English Declaration of Rights of 1688-89. This is a document that American historians don't usually talk very much about, but it was clearly in the minds of 18th century Americans. It is a document that Parliament issued when they were removing, when James II had left England, and they were about to declare the end of his reign, to justify the end of his reign, and to put William and Mary on the throne. But it's a terribly interesting document. It begins by stating the basic rights of Englishmen and the way in which, a statement that James had violated these. Kind of similar to these documents. And then the last part actually declares the new regime on the notion that William and Mary would be better, would better protect the rights and liberties of Englishmen. I think the three parts of that document correspond to different families of documents in the American tradition, that the arguments against James II, saying that he had violated the rights and liberties of the English, is very much like our declarations of independence. The statements of basic rights, the assertion of them, which is the middle part of the English document, we have relegated to what we call bills of rights, without the beginning and the end of the English document. The third part, I think, corresponds to our constitutions. We decided not to get another king. We decided, I suppose, convinced by Thomas Paine and by others making the same argument, that rights and liberties were no longer safe under kings. They were like institutionalized loaded cannons. You couldn't contain their power. So we would go a different route. We would form a republic under a written constitution. So, of course, our documents are much more elaborate than the third part of the English Declaration of Rights. In any case, obviously, Jefferson was very conscious of the case against James II. It was clearly a model in his mind. He had written in May 1776 a preamble for the Virginia Constitution, which was, for all practical purposes, a Declaration of Independence. And he essentially was rephrasing the English Declaration of Rights. If you look at the whereas clauses and the language and the statement of grievances, it mimics the English Declaration. And we know he used his draft preamble for the Virginia Constitution in writing Congress's declaration, but he changed the word in a way that further distanced it from the English model in his own, if you will, act of independence. But here you can really trace, hey, there's a loaded gun here. You know, we can see the smoke. You can trace the change in wording. Clearly, he was very influenced by that document.
Are there any other American documents that influenced him? I was thinking of Mason's.
Mason's Declaration of Rights. I think that's obviously a very important document. There is dispute over this, I will say. The great Jefferson scholar Julian Boyd once said that there was never any evidence that, and never could be any evidence that Jefferson had used Mason's draft. I should explain what Mason's draft is. The Virginians, in the middle of May 1776, at the same time that they decided to instruct their delegates to Congress to propose independence, decided that they would draft their own independent constitution and annex to it a Bill of Rights. The major draftsman of this, both of those documents, was a planter named George Mason. The first document to be issued was the Declaration of Rights, which is, if you will, I think the document of American liberties, not the Declaration of Independence, the Mason draft of the Virginia Declaration of Rights. It begins in a way that's very familiar to us, that all men are born equally free and independent. It sounds vaguely familiar. It sounds vaguely familiar because this document was clearly known to Jefferson. It was published in the Pennsylvania Gazette, June 12, 1776, the day after Congress had appointed a committee to draft the Declaration of Independence, conceivably the day the committee first met. And Julian Boyd notwithstanding, if you look at the texts, which we can now do, the successive drafts, if you will, of the Declaration of Independence, you can see that what Jefferson did was to use Mason's text, which he compressed because he was using it for a very different purpose. He was using it to compose a revolutionary document which declared the end of the old regime, not to lay out principles, as in a Bill of Rights, to govern a new regime for an established government. And so he compressed it, and you can see what he did, whereas Mason said, all men are born equally free and independent. Jefferson's first version was, all men are created equal and independent. And then he crossed out and independent. And you're left with all men are created equal. And he did rather the same things with subsequent parts of Mason's language. There are two questions here. Did he do this on his own or on instruction from the committee? We'll never know. We do know from John Adams that when the drafting committee met, it discussed what the Declaration of Independence should look like. It decided what parts it should contain. And it wrote down its instructions, the conclusions of its, the result of its discussion as to what this document should look like, and gave it as instructions to the person appointed to draft it. Now, whether those minutes, as John Adams called them, said, and give us a kind of a restatement of this Mason language because it really swings, or whether Jefferson said, you know, George really had it right, we could use some of that in this document, we don't know. But I think the source is clear. You know, whether he did it on his own or because a committee told him to, we don't know. We'll never know, probably. That's, of course, fateful. Sometimes some things do turn up and they add to the story.
What did Americans or Congress feel it had to write a Declaration of Independence? It's still, they're at war already. Who was the audience for this declaration?
Well, there are two questions here. Why did they do it and what is the audience? Why did they do it? They did it again because this is well-based in English tradition. Since the 14th century, the English had displaced something like seven living kings, but they never ended a reign or regime without issuing some kind of an explanation. And the English being English, the explanations became precedents and the precedents became limitations. And by the 18th century, it was quite clear you could only displace a living king for one of two reasons. He was inept, had a wonderful phrase for this, rex inutilis, useless king. This king is useless. Or the king was evil in the sense that he interfered with the rights and freedoms of the people. And in that tradition, what the Congress was doing was sort of raising its hand and saying, hey, world, we had the evil kind. And that is the justification. I think that's very important, independent of everything else. The need to explain, which limits the resort to ending regimes, I think helps to explain why the Americans and other people who have a British background have constitutional crises, whereas certain nations, in any case, with different traditions, have coup d'etat. This is not a resort that the people of a British illegal heritage take lightly.
Elaborating on this legal response, you have a wonderful section on William Henry Drayton, the Chief Justice of South Carolina, and he's opening the General Court of Sessions.
South Carolina, yeah. Yes.
And he begins with a briefing the jury in a rather unusual way.
Yes.
Could you comment on
this? Well, this was a document, I must say, I came across with such delight. William Henry Drayton was the Chief Justice of the new Supreme Court, essentially, of the state of South Carolina, which I think had adopted a new constitution in March 1776. So the court first meets in April. He's convening the court. He decides this is an extraordinary occasion. I have to confront it in a rather unusual way. So he decides to talk about the bases of the current revolution, why it was the Americans were becoming disaffected from Britain. And basically what he does is to declare South Carolina independent of Britain. And again, he uses the English Declaration of Rights. He mimics it. You know, what's very funny about this, though, is that they use the wrong version of the English Declaration of Rights. Here's a job for some graduate student out there to figure out where they got the wrong version. In 1688-89, the Whigs, that is those who had what we think of as a Lockean contractual conception of their situation. That is that the king had broken his contract with the people and de-kinged himself, had a version which basically referred to these principles. It didn't wash in Parliament. There are too many Tories. And so the final text of the English Declaration of Right is, as the historian Lois Schwarz said, most unsatisfactory as a statement of political principle. But the earlier Whig version obviously made a lot of sense to the Americans. And somehow that's the one they cite all the time. I don't even know where they got it. But it is most peculiar. I think that they assumed that actually Whig ideas were official English ideology. I mean, they'd read it in Locke. Hey, they find this version that sounds sort of Lockean. That must be right. It didn't happen to be the right version, but they're using it all the time. And Drayton does this. And most peculiar, he says, by virtue of his right as Chief Justice of South Carolina, based on Blackstone, he was going to declare South Carolina independent of Britain because, hey, George III had done everything James II had done, only worse.
Who were the audience for this?
For whom was it written?
The French or the Americans or what?
The common assumption, I think, and Gary Wills has contributed to this, is that the document was written for a European and particularly a French audience. I don't think the evidence sustains that. It does, of course, make some reference to a candid world, but the colonists, the Congress had done that in its declaration on taking up arms in 1774, which was also largely for a domestic audience. I believe that this document was mainly for domestic consumption. Certainly, after the Congress adopted it, its instructions for its dissemination had only to do with North America. They wanted it distributed and read at the heads of the army and distributed to the states so it would be proclaimed or published, that is, made public, in such a way that the mass of the people would be aware of it. Now, this is, okay, this is the justification of independence, but here we get to its second function. It's a kind of an 18th century press announcement. It's a way of getting the news to the people that they were no longer a colony of Great Britain, that they had taken a separate state.
And how actually did they do this in the days
before
television?
Well, they, in some places, Connecticut, I think they just published it in the newspaper. But in other places, they sent it out, and it would be read wherever the people gathered. In Virginia, it was on court days. In Massachusetts, I found it quite touching that the general court, which is the legislature of Massachusetts, instructed ministers to read it after the regular services on the Sabbath, because that's where the people of Massachusetts would congregate. Each state basically decided what would be the best way to get the message to its people. And so there's a tremendous amount of local variation on that score. But the episodes are very similar. I mean, they'd be read publicly, and often there was an appropriate display of ritual. You know, the militia might march, they would shoot some guns, they would shout huzzah, and they would then go rip down symbols of the king from the tavern, from the courthouse. In New York, they destroyed a statue, actually, of George III. So it was a way, one can find it being read publicly to crowds of people, and then these sort of celebrations, if you will, following.
Now,
so the question is, what about France? France isn't, I mean, what the French were interested in was the fact of independence. They were not going to help the colonies patch up the British Empire. Up to July 2nd, 1776, the colonists had kept saying, what we really want is reconciliation. You know, we want to stay within the empire. Well, there was no reason whatsoever that France should help Britain clean up its stable, so to speak. What they were willing to do, what they wanted to do, was to help break up the British Empire. They were, you know, traditional rivals. The French were still smarting from their great loss at British hands in the 7 years of French and Indian War. They would only support the colonists if they declared their independence. So the critical act was done on July 2nd. July 4th is the declaration. Are we really to believe that a statement of the basic equality and inherent rights of all men, or the fact that government is created to support the rights of the people, was going to increase the willingness of Louis XVI to support the American cause? It wasn't because of the American principles, it wasn't because of the American ideology that the French, and particularly the French monarchy, was going to support the American colonies. It was for real politique. They were going to get back at the British, which means that independence was important, but not the declaration. And in fact, we sent the declaration to France in the most slipshod fashion. Silas Deane was the minister there. They packed it in a boat. It got intercepted. It never arrived. They sent another copy. It arrived in November. He said, what kind of a way is this to send an important public document? It wasn't even sealed. Not only that, by the time I get it, the news is all over Europe, and you expect me to officially to present this to the court of France? I mean, they said maybe you should get it, you know, maybe you should get it translated. You know, it was slipshod. That's not where their heart was. Their heart was the Congress's heart, the Congress's instruction were how to distribute it to the American people. They would know of independence. They were no longer fighting for reconciliation. Here, there's a much better reason, among other things, for people to join the army, to fight for an independent country. Come on, this was a great recruiting scheme, and the Army, God knows the Army needed help in 1776.
I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the Declaration itself, Jefferson setting out to prove that the king was attempting to establish an absolute tyranny, and then, as you say, the Declaration submitted facts to a candid world.
A candid world.
Now, are these charges that are leveled against the king, are they so obscure as to be frivolous?
They had, I think, I divide them into three parts. The first are things that happened largely within provinces. He moved legislatures away from their records to remote and uncomfortable places. I mean, etc., etc. A lot of people didn't know what they were talking about. They're talking about, I think, most probably the royal governors moving the Massachusetts General Court from Boston to Cambridge.
Here
this
we
was
have one
pretty
that I like.
Easy to answer. They said Cambridge isn't uncomfortable. It isn't so far away either. I mean, you know, what crazy answer is, what kind of a crazy charge is this?
What does this one mean? He refused his consent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good.
A wonderful question. I mean, people wouldn't immediately know what that means. I know what he meant because Jefferson made a similar set of charge in an earlier summary of 1774. What he was really mad about, and indeed he refers to it again later, was that the king had vetoed an effort of the Virginia legislature to tax the slave trade, and therefore to curb the importation of slaves into Virginia. As Jefferson would have had it, the young idealistic Jefferson, as a first step conceivably toward abolishing the slave system. But it was possible to see this also as a way for major planters to line their pockets. That is, if they cut off the supply of new slaves, those who are already there would increase in value, good old supply and demand. And so for people who were pushing into Western areas who wanted slaves as a labor force, they would have to pay more to guess who? The Virginia planters who dominated the House of Burgesses. What was it? Was it idealistic or self-serving? It was possible to see it one way or the other. In any case, the king had refused to let Virginia do this. Certainly, you know, it contributed to to the British Treasury to let the slave trade continue, and other states had also, or colonies as they were at that point, also an attempt to curb the slave trade, and that's really what he was talking about there, I think. Although it's so stated in such general terms, it could apply to any number of measures.
Here's another one: that the king had suffered the administration of justice totally to cease in some of these states. Does that refer to anything specific?
Well, this court system in North Carolina had more or less collapsed, and that's one of the lines that the Congress changed. The Congress spent 2 days editing the draft that Jefferson had produced with the help of the drafting committee, and they changed this totally to cease. Well, I can, off the top of my head, I can remember precisely how they changed it, but in fact, the system hadn't totally ceased. Some courts had ceased to function and others were, and they changed it so that it was much more of an accurate statement of the situation mm-hmm. as it had occurred.
Well, are the colonists simply being hypocritical? They list all these charges, some of which we can't even identify today. We have trouble in doing so. Why are they listing so many and so many that are seemingly obscure?
Well, I think it follows from the Jefferson's second paragraph, the part that Americans don't remember, where he says, you know, obviously you can't just, it isn't casual abuses of power. It has to be a long line of abuses. And, you know, not just accidental events, but a long line of abuses, long chain of abuses. And so he needs a big list. And that's why he has a much more substantial list here than you will find in these town or county statements. I think that is the reason it's so long. And most of them are, I mean, the first part are particularly obscure because they're events that occurred entirely within the separate provinces, which had never figured very prominently in the previous protests of the Continental Congress. You didn't find it in the Stamp Act Congress votes, for example. The first continent, some of them just never appeared there. Where you get to the familiar events is where he said he has combined with others, and the others to whom that line refers are the members of the British Parliament. And there you get all the parliamentary acts, which had really given structure to earlier American protests, the Stamp Act, the efforts to tax the colonies, the prohibition on the Prohibitory Act that put American ships outside the king's protection, and as John Adams and others said, therefore made us independent. If you don't protect us, allegiance is not due. The usual acts that we cite or that we teach in tracing the development of American independence are just in that part. Then there's actually the final section, which is the acts of 1775 to 76 that appear more prominently in the local statements.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the revolution was inevitable? If there hadn't been the grievances that were listed in the Declaration of Independence, do you think that Americans would have become independent anyway, or?
Well, Thomas Paine said it's against nature for an island to rule a continent. I don't think we're quite so given to natural metaphors as explanations of inevitability. To say, would this have happened without the grievances is to read history in an entirely different way. What we do know, I mean, is to read it backwards. The fact is, there were the grievances, and the grievances are what the local statements use to explain their decision for independence. But they all say, we didn't want this, we didn't seek it.
Are
What
they
we
being
wanted
hypocritical or
above,
not?
no, I don't think they were. See, the king, I think, thought they were. He received all of these protests that they didn't want to be independent, that the Americans were loyal to the king, that they wanted nothing more than reconciliation. And in the fall of 1775, he said these petitions were, quote, meant only to amuse. This is October 1775. In other words, he just discredited them. But I don't think so. I think these local statements, which do have the ring of truth to them, and it certainly is consonant with the whole pattern of American conduct, said they wanted most to remain in the British Empire. They spoke British. This is their tradition. This where they were raised from children to respect this tradition, to think of the British Constitution, which is just the British system of government, of course, not a written document, as the best man had ever devised. They took pride in that. They had no desire to separate. They felt they only did it because they were forced into it. But then sometimes you get these, in 1776, again, these local documents, quite delightful statements that, you know, we never wanted this. We did everything to avoid it. But, you know, now that we have it, it's better. I took particular delight in a statement from the Cheraws district, and I'm of South Carolina, which I'm probably mispronouncing since I mispronounce all kinds of South Carolinian locations. But they said, you know, we take such pride in this form of government, and they would go through the whole list of changes. You know, the before the king and parliament regulated the economy for the good of Britain. Hey, now we're free to go after our own welfare. You know, we can do things we were precluded from doing before. Hey, we can govern ourselves. We don't have to have those dumb governors they sent over here. We can have someone who knows our situation, who cares about us, who's not trying to please the king, but trying to please us, the governed. You know, what we tried most to avoid, what we tried so desperately to avoid, turns out to be the best outcome. So just by experiencing self-government, the colonists came to discover its charms. They would never have discovered it, I don't think, were it not for the British, as they said repeatedly, sort of pushing them out.
How influential do you think Tom Paine was in all this debate?